like the kind of lady who appreciates a real tomato. Oh, they're heirloom, baby, I picked them just yesterday. Drove down in this old yellow Ford. I know you think it's huge, but you ain't seen my zucchini. I studied biology, no. And I built a house up in a tree, and now the birds fly all around me while I play my fiddle or write poems. Like I wanna make you scream, feed you my dreams. Oh baby, come on by, 'cause tonight we could be together right out this stormy weather. Oh baby, come on by. On a pile of flowers I hope nobody sees, 'cause she's got a hang down my pants and I can't help myself. Oh, tell me you're 18. Voice in the distance says you open for business. This spinach is delicious, bittersweet. And she says I'm glad I came by your stand. Give me the big one, veggie man, and I'll see you next week. Oh, I wanna make you scream, feed you my greens. Oh baby, come on by, 'cause tonight we could be together right out this stormy weather. Oh baby, come on by.
Swan.
I'm Chris.
And this is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. This week we met with Sarah Quiroz, who is the librarian at the International Culinary Center in Soho. She is also creator of the Snacks in the Stacks literary mailer. It features books with food pairings. And we met Sarah at the second annual Book Riot Live a couple weekends ago. And there she invited us to tour the library and we took her up on her offer. A little bit about the International Culinary Center, or ICC. It started in 1984 as the French Culinary Institute. They changed their name in 2001. Today, they have multiple campuses, an impressive list of alumni, and offer a diverse range of programs and classes. Sarah was such a lovely person, and she also loves her job. We had a great time talking to her, and we hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to the ICC Library. I'll take you over here. This is a good place to start. We're organized by the Dewey Decimal System, which isn't really ideal for our collection, but it's been in place since the very beginning, and we have over 5,000 volumes, so it would have been
pretty overwhelming to reorganize it.
Yeah, exactly. So we start with all the memoirs and biographies and fiction. And then we have agriculture. We do have a farm-to-table program here. And then this is all kind of like food writing, gastronomy, nutrition, things like that. And then we get a little into wine because we have a sommelier program. I showed you guys this piece downstairs. And this is the only portion that I adapted because the original system was just red and white, which isn't really helpful for people who study wine. So I added on regional call numbers to go with it. So it's divided up by Old World and New World, and then further down to region.
Because wine, you can get pretty specific.
Yeah, it's a lot. And here's some more like food writing and history and that type of thing. Yeah. And then all the cookbooks start over here. We have like preservation, pickling. These are all kind of general. We have a section for restaurants. A lot of people look based on, you know, their favorite chef or someone who got a Michelin star, things like that.
And alumni.
Yeah, all the yellow labels are people who went here.
Mm-hmm.
And these are sort of by meal. So there's lunch, dinner, things like that. And then it gets into health.
Like diet, more like diet-based.
Vegetarian, yeah, diet-based. And then from there, geography starts, and that's almost the rest of the library. So we have the biggest section for French since we were founded as the French Culinary.
Yeah, I saw that.
But then, you know, we also have Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, Russian, Scandinavian, a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And around here, it starts with Asian, and then that's divided down more specifically
in country.
China, Korea. And again, all of this is just based on Dewey. I just followed his direction.
The breakdowns.
Yeah.
So you talked about that being a little bit limiting. Is that more in the sense of like getting the right book in the right category for you to like find it again?
Yeah.
Because I imagine a lot of books can probably go in multiple spots.
Oh, yeah. Like Oda Lenji, are you guys familiar with him?
Mm-hmm.
He's a really brilliant shelf. He has a lot of books out. And his first book, just self-titled Oda Lenji, is he's a Israeli man, but he has a restaurant in London. And he does, it's like general, it's a lot of different stuff, but he also does some vegetarian. He did a vegetarian column for The Guardian.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it could be in a lot of different places.
Yeah.
Like, it's obviously not British cuisine, so I wouldn't put it there, but that's where it actually is geographically. So things like that, or where the hard decisions had to be made.
Yeah,
that must get increasingly difficult if you figure, like, globalism, you know,
absolutely.
Food cultures, all
fusions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you feel about fusions?
I mean, I think it's evolved to a point now. People don't really say fusion anymore.
Yeah.
It's like a dirty word.
It is.
Everybody does it a little bit. You know, you look at like Ivan Ramen. He is so successful, and he's doing, you know, like he's combining Jewish with Japanese, Chinese. You know, like. Japanese ramen is originally from China, so it's like this whole, I guess it's just like you said, globalism.
Yeah. And it's moving around.
Right. So if it's done well, it's really good. And now this is about the end of the regional. And we have a little
spices.
Section on spices, a little section on fruit, a little section on veg.
So I'm curious, I feel like in the history of books, cookbooks came like after. What would you say like cookbooks started being a thing?
Oh,
that were,
I can
like,
show you. Let's
published?
Go back this way.
Yeah.
The first cookbooks were well, we have the very first cookbook here. Obviously, a reprint, not the
not
original.
The first.
I have my little tiny Ancient World section. Here it is: Cookery and Dining in Imperial Rome.
Perfect.
And
with illustrations.
Really from about here up through colonial times, there weren't a lot of specific detail. They didn't write recipes the way we write them today. Everything produced during that huge span of time was for people who were already professionals, right? So this would be like the guy who cooks for the emperor or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like everyone had it in their home to figure out dinner.
Right.
You knew that. Like your mother taught you. And then you
it was
your
an
daughter.
Oral and like tactile tradition.
Exactly. I actually just found that out recently because I was on Wen Jie's show talking about Thanksgiving, and so we did a lot of research about it. And it was right around colonial times that women started getting more interested in having cookbooks in their home. But prior to that, it was basically just professional chefs cooking for huge households or, you know, courts. That kind of situation.
Interesting.
So,
cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a really different way of cooking. I feel like now everyone wants to be super coddled, and they want every single detail.
They want pictures of each step.
Yeah, yeah. Know? What does it look like now? What does it look like now? Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of people too in the food world too. Yeah. So just like getting name recognition for yourself as a chef and as a cookbook writer.
Definitely, it's tough.
Mountain in and of itself.
Yeah.
Do you have a current favorite?
Oh, that's like asking a mother to choose.
I know.
Favorite child.
Do you like a best recent read?
I just recently cooked out of the Groundnut Cookbook, which is, it started as a supper club in London, and it's three guys that all grew up in Africa. And then when they got to London, there wasn't enough good African food there, and they wanted to introduce it to all their friends. So it's a cool book because it covers, it's not one specific country, it's like all different countries throughout Africa. And in each meal, too, they're combining cuisine from all over the continent. And it's broken down by meal. It's not like appetizers, entrees. It's like, this is the way we did our parties, and we suggest that you do the same.
It's really nice. That's fun. So what did you make?
I made rice jollof. Because, have you had it before?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Have you had it before?
I don't know.
I had never had it, but I kept reading. I've been reading a lot of Adichie lately. I just finished Americana.
Ah, yes.
And all her characters love it. And so that got me curious, and I wanted to try it.
After showing us the books, we relocated to Sarah's office.
Ooh, so you were telling us about your most recent cooking adventure, and what was the cookbook's name again? Or what was
it's called the Groundnut Cookbook.
Groundnut.
Mm-hmm.
These guys met and made African food. Do they talk about, because something I'm noticing as a theme is the acquisition of the quote-unquote right ingredients to make a dish.
Yeah.
They talk about that.
Yeah, they have
London.
Tips for it. And it's funny, I was expecting the recipe to be spicier. It was a little too bland for me. And it wasn't until afterwards when I was completely finished, I thought, oh, they're probably doing it for a British palate.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense.
But yeah, we had a guest speaker here at the school. We do a How to Write a Cookbook series. And one of our guest speakers was saying how if you're publishing out of your country, you always need to find a recipe tester in the country where you want to sell it just to tell you this is way off, this isn't going to work, you know.
Interesting.
That makes sense. Like even, I mean, you think about if you go to, say, like a Thai restaurant in New York City, they'll ask, like, you know, what level of spice you want because they're trying to cater to you versus
and
what.
If you say very spicy, they try and tone you back. They're like, it's pretty spicy.
Yeah, definitely.
That makes sense. Do you have any thoughts or questions after walking through the library?
Not yet. Still formulating.
Still forming. We did mention you just did a show with
with Wenjay.
Yeah, and talked about Thanksgiving. You were mentioning research for that. Tell us a little bit about Thanksgiving because it always comes up a lot. Of like the original Thanksgiving meal and how it's like not a turkey and stuff.
Yeah,
the things that are so almost rigidly traditional now.
Yeah,
I was listening to a podcast about the author who wrote an article changing the official meal of Thanksgiving to pasta carbonara. Have you heard of that?
No.
He talks about how it's a more like American and easy meal for like, and he wants to like, push. To change it.
Wow. Yeah, it was really fun. Wenjay does a show on Little Water Radio called Naked Food, and you can check that out online.
I'll put a link.
Yes. Thank you. and she had a whole Thanksgiving show, and we were talking about different ideas of what you can cook, but it's true. All we really know, where turkey comes from is that there was a record of wild fowl being served. But we don't know exactly what that was. We're just guessing it was wild turkey.
It's actually pigeon all this time.
Possibly.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? And one of the most interesting things was actually the similarity more than the difference. Some of the earliest pumpkin pie recipes were almost exactly the same as what we make now. Barely changed at all. But we also know that the wheat crop failed that year, right? That's the big thing. The reason there was a Thanksgiving is because they were so grateful to be alive. It was more of
an event about prayer and, you know, thanking God that they had survived.
Right.
And so rather than using a traditional crust, they would use the shell of the pumpkin. Oh. So for any gluten-free folks out there in the paleo, you can just pour it back in the pumpkin after you mix it and bake it right in there.
That's an interesting concept.
It's kind of good.
Yeah, that's really neat. I kind of want to try it now. Back home.
Yeah.
It's always a question, especially after Halloween, like, what do you do with all the pumpkins?
Yeah.
I stayed at a kind of a permaculture friendly, I guess, house. I lived in their treehouse and in their greenhouse. And every winter they would just have mountains and mountains of gourds and like squashes, because that's like what you can keep and eat through the winter. So many delicious soups.
Yeah.
but with the like traditional like fall decoration, like what do you do with the pumpkins after it's not fall anymore?
Yeah.
You can make them and apparently use them for pie crust.
Yeah.
Scrub them off.
Yeah, yeah. Scrub it first.
Yeah. Please clean.
We met at Book Riot Live, where you were on a panel about librarians and beyond the library. And it sounds like you switched from a job you loved into your dream job just from that panel. Do you want to talk a little bit about being a librarian and how that has kind of influenced you?
Sure.
Especially working with such a specific intersection
of
librarian and food.
Absolutely. I'm one of those oddballs that I just always knew I wanted to be a librarian. I wasn't.
Don't we all?
I mean, I wasn't a career changer. I knew from a very young age. I actually read Malcolm X's autobiography when I was probably like 14, 15. And he talks about going to the library while he was incarcerated and how that was the only factor that kept him from going back to the streets and hustling again.
Wow.
And that just stuck with me my whole life. As soon as I saw that, I was like, I want to facilitate those type of experiences for people. And I've always loved books ever since I was really young, you know, as we all do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So everyone listening too.
Fence, yeah.
Books.
So that was pretty much my single-minded goal for a while, was to get to library school. And when I finished, I worked a bunch of different part-time jobs all over the place. I graduated right during the recession, so there wasn't really a lot out there.
Tons of library jobs.
Funding. So I worked at a university in Guatemala for one semester. Mm. I worked at Brooklyn Law School Library for a while. I was actually working. Did you guys go to the Rethinking Justice panel as well?
I think we were at that.
There was so much stuff going on, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's hard to remember.
Book Riot Live pretty much had three things going on consistently over the course of 2 days, and so you had to pick
it
and
was
choose.
So hard.
I had that
difficult decisions.
Yeah, and it was. Last year they had them staggered.
Yeah,
and so you could like catch the first part of one and the second part of another. But I wonder if they changed it so that you can't. Maybe
so Clue to Book Riot, maybe.
Yeah.
Anyone's listening.
I can't even imagine organizing such a big event.
I know.
Decide what happens and.
Yeah.
So Rethinking Justice.
I used to work with Emily Jacobson, who was on that panel. I was at New York Public in Correctional Services, and we were going out to Rikers, and we were doing mail reference throughout the country, a bunch of different things. And then from there, I got hired at Queens Public Library. That was sort of the transition, and I was working with people more on the opposite side, like trying to find jobs and that kind of stuff. And then this job just popped up, and I've always been a home cook and a cookbook collector. Mm-hmm. Well, no, I'm lying to you.
Let me be honest. God damn
actually,
it.
Or have had intrigue with it.
When I first moved here, I would pretty much just eat slices of pizza and bagels.
Because they're so good.
I mean, like, that's what New York's known for.
I never used to cook. So it's been really the last few years that I learned to cook. But maybe that explains my passion for it. Maybe I'm compensating.
Sick of pizza and bagels.
Right. So I became a recent home cook.
And it feels like you've always been one.
Yeah.
It was like
stepping
into a role.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I mentioned a few memoirs to you. I love chef memoirs and food writing, and I collect cookbooks. And so I think that's what helped me in getting this job, because I think the ideal candidate probably would have had a culinary diploma and a library science degree, but we're kind of niche. There's not a lot of people like that.
I would be surprised if there is such a person.
Yeah. if you are, call in. I want to meet you. Let's be friends.
Yeah, we should gather all the people that love the food and books.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it, and it's even though it's such a big market, it actually is also kind of a small world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, once you're in it,
definitely.
You keep bumping up against the same things.
Definitely. Yeah. And I've also noticed a lot of people, like a lot of friends, a lot of people I meet in the city who don't cook at all. They just live on takeout. They still love food writing.
Mm-hmm.
They'll still read a book, you know, like Blood, Bones, and Butter or like Kitchen Confidential and just,
well, and
I don't know, there's something about
it. Writing. I feel like when you write about food, it just gets really sensual and it ties into experience and relationships and, you know.
And memory.
Emotion. Yeah. So you're touching on everything that makes us human, I think, in community, you know. So
absolutely.
It makes sense that people love it even if they don't actively cook
from them
on a regular basis. Thoughts?
I was wondering about if you think, so I mean, obviously this library is chock full of cookbooks and great resources. Do you think the wider New York public library system like has enough like cookbooks and food books?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Wow.
This is the city.
I know.
Food.
Yeah.
it really
but,
is.
I mean, I don't know. Continue.
I mean, there's a lot out there. I'd say if you're thinking about buying a cookbook, go check your library first. They may very well have it. Some of the more specialty stuff, you know, like we have the Nomad cookbook. I doubt they have that at NYPL.
So specific.
I've never checked, but some of them, I mean, they can be really pricey. And budgets are always a concern, you know, even for me. Like, even though that's my whole focus, even though I have to buy those books, it's still kind of like, oh, how do I balance this?
Interesting. So how do you, like, what is the compromise between acquiring a book and, like, the cost?
It's tough.
You just have to make
tough calls. Yeah. I mean, I'm really blessed in that I have a lot of freedom here. It's almost always up to me. My supervisor, Rob Satius, is our director of education, and he's really great, and he loves books. But even despite loving them so much, he's very hands-off. He's like, I trust you. You're trained in this. It's your decision to make, you know. I always go based off of what the chefs request from me because you don't want to upset a chef. Anyone who knows them knows. You want to keep them happy.
We've seen enough reality TV.
Yeah.
The dangers.
I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not like that here, but.
Yeah, not every chef is me.
It's not Hell's Kitchen at ICC. Nothing like that. But, you know, still, I want to keep them happy. I want to keep myself full, you know.
Yeah.
So you acquire books and obviously do research in what's coming out and, you know, the local things and, you know, global trends. What, on a day-to-day basis, like, what are some other interesting things that happen in a culinary library?
I love the reference questions I get here. It's so much fun. I had someone come in, a staff member, who remembered having this cake in her childhood in Jamaica, and she had been calling all her relatives and nobody could really tell her the recipe. It was like they would just kind of,
it's just the cake,
whip it up, right?
Yeah.
And so we're pulling every book I have, Caribbean, Southern, American, British, that has a black rum cake in it. And she's like reading through, trying to figure out, she's like, well, I think this one will be too hard. I want like a soft frosting. Is there something like a buttercream? And it was just, it's one of those things that I mean, honestly, I've never tasted. I've never had a black rum cake and I've never thought about much before.
Right.
But there's just an infinite variety of slight little changes for all these cakes from all these different places. So those type of projects I love. That's so fun to me.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, the heritage and history. I was reading a Ruth Reichel book. I forgot the name of it. It was one you recommended. I'll put it in the notes. But it went into a little bit of the history of balsamic vinegar and how families, like, you couldn't purchase it in a store. Like, families would make it. And, like, when it first, you know, started hitting tables in restaurants, that was, it was, nobody knew, like, where to get it, which is so fascinating because balsamic vinegar is like the vinegar now. Mm-hmm. Like that's the one that people know. So what a shift from like household specific recipes to balsamic vinegar being what it is today.
And just recently.
Yeah.
For people who love geeking out on food history and that type of stuff, there's a really cool book called The United States of Arugula.
Uh-huh.
And
I
it
like
sort
the title
of goes, it's great. it goes through how America became gourmet, quote unquote. And like it used to be much like they talk about the balsamic vinegar. Also, we never used to be able to get arugula here. And I want to say it was like one of the chefs or sous chefs at Chez Panisse brought seeds from France, like smuggled them and started growing them. And that started the whole thing here.
And then it became such a commodity. You can. No, you're okay.
Can we do that?
That's in there. They can get it. I think, yeah, she got it. Just cut it out. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Don't worry about it.
You're waiting. You're right before an event, so we understand the
theme. I'm okay probably up until about 2:45 or 3:00. So.
Okay.
Swap. Cool.
One thing I want to...
So arugula. Yeah. And then the whole book is full of different anecdotes like that of... all these things that we just completely take for granted now that we're so used to.
Especially younger generations, too. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting. It's one of those, I think one of my core values and that I keep reflecting on more is just, like, where does something come from?
Yeah.
Because if you don't know where it's coming from and what you're supporting, then, like, you're not being aware and intentional with your money, with your lifestyle choices. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, and incorporating that into... I grew up kind of really connected to my food.
Mm.
Like, my dad had chickens, and we had a garden every summer. And so, for me, it was like I knew where my food came from. So, it was kind of a disconnect interacting with a larger population and just, oh, that comes from the grocery store, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's really unfortunate. We have a farm-to-table program here that I help to coordinate. And... that's a big focus for that class, obviously, you know, and we've even had some students go through the whole thing. And at the end of it, even though they've taken all of our classes, they decide like, well, actually, I want to be a farmer instead of a chef.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
It's like makes me swoon a little bit.
Oh, have you guys been up to Stone Barns?
No. Stone Barns.
It's so great. It's in Pleasantville. It's Chef Dan Barber. He's actually an alumni of our school.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote a brilliant book called The Third Plate. But
oh, I have seen that.
It's fantastic. I cannot recommend it enough. But the whole vision there is the cuisine is really farmer driven. So rather than saying to your farmer, oh, I need tomatoes, and it's the middle of winter or whatever, the chefs go out there and they go, what do you have? How should I prepare it?
What will be harvest?
Right. And so it's really a partnership. So when our students finish the program here, they go up there for a week, and each day they spend half the day in the kitchen and half the day on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really on both ends of it.
Both worlds. It seems like that's something, I feel like maybe especially recently, but that's on most chefs' radar.
Yeah.
Is that accurate? It's like a
definitely
pretty safe statement.
Definitely. And I think more and more people are going towards it. And even like with cookbooks, I've noticed it used to be sort of rare and niche that a cookbook would be seasonal. And we have a seasonal section, and I used to put anything in there that was divided by spring, summer, fall, winter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now so many people are doing that that can't be the top choice for classification anymore. You know, going back to what we were talking about, I have to look through it more and try to figure out, well, where exactly does it go?
Mm-hmm.
Just because it has seasonal headings, that doesn't mean that's the whole theme of the book. Right. You know, you can have a seasonal book that's regionally focused or seafood focused or, you know, whatever.
So I want to... I'm basically hoping you'll repeat something you said at Book Riot, because here you have a very specific role, but you used to work at Queen's Public Library.
Mm-hmm.
How does the public support a library if they don't necessarily have money?
Oh, everyone should get a library card, first of all. Yeah, I tried to publicly shame. I told everyone.
Do you have one?
Yeah.
Get one.
So that's huge. Like, even if, because sometimes people say, well, I don't have time. I don't have money. Like, I can't, there's nothing I can do. But that's the first thing that you should do is cities are looking at that.
It's a numbers game on a basic level.
Right. And so that's the first part. And then, of course, if you have money, donate it. Of course, if you have the time, donate it. I'm sorry, I gotta step out for just a second.
No, sure. No problem. No, we'll pause it. So it's the numbers game, you know, funding and government is looking
and
at
if
how many
books
people
are important
have.
To you. Don't just buy it on Amazon. Check it out, you know, or request it as a hold. Like even here, that's how I choose what to weed. As I look, have people been borrowing this book or not? If not, unfortunately, sometimes I have to get rid of it. I have limited space.
Right.
And it's the same thing with the public library. You know, like if you feel like there aren't enough cookbooks at the library in your neighborhood, well,
check out
ask
the ones
librarian.
They have.
Check out the ones that they have. You know.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
So we are going to start wrapping up. We like to end our shows with a rapid fire series of questions. You can say I don't know. Okay. The question that I like has nothing to do with books, but
can I talk about my newsletter a little?
Oh, please. Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Yeah, we started talking about there. That's what we, like, drove us.
Sell
in
yourself.
I forgot about it. So Snacks in the Stacks.
I gotta push my hustle. So I write a newsletter called Snacks in the Stacks.
Yes.
And I've been doing it for about a year. Actually, my 1 year anniversary is coming up. Mm. So I'm gonna do a nice giveaway. If you have not already subscribed, subscribe now.
Yeah.
It's a tiny letter and it's not too much. It's not too overwhelming. Yeah. It's every other week on Mondays, and I do book reviews and food pairings with them. And I have a little event guide of some, like, fun foodie bookish stuff that's coming up, and I always have a recipe.
Great.
Thank you.
And my question earlier that we got distracted was, tell me about how that, like, how did you conceive that Snacks in the Stacks? Where did that come from?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was kind of funny. Actually, a part of it, even though, like you were saying, I love this job, dream job, perfect scenario, all that. One thing I really missed about the public library is I would be working out of Flushing, which is one of the biggest branches of Queens Library. It's huge. It's busy. And there's a huge display in front with all the new books that came out. And every day on my way out, I would, like, grab a novel, you know. And being here, we don't really have that much leisure reading.
Right.
And so I was kind of getting out of that and just really missing it. And I wanted to come up with, actually, I listened to your interview with Tom Wolfe.
Ah.
And it was just like he was saying how you have to create something for yourself to, like, force yourself to be creative and hold yourself accountable.
Uh-huh.
I was like, this isn't ever going to fall in my lap. So how do I make myself keep reading, keep writing?
For fun.
You know, get more creative about what I'm cooking. I think we kind of get in a recipe rut where we're just
this
the go-to.
You have your like handful of meals and then
right. So that's where the idea came from, was kind of merging the two, my love of books and then my love of cooking.
Swell. Okay, rapid fire. Non-related question is, what's your favorite podcast or streaming addiction?
I love Call Your Girlfriend.
Okay, what's that?
Call Your Girlfriend is the writer Anne Friedman.
Oh.
And the tech mogul. I don't know what you call her. Amina Tuso. She was at Google and now she's at Racked.
Okay.
And they're just, like, brilliant, smart, funny, feminist boss ladies. They talk about politics, feminism, pop culture, like a little bit of everything. I really love it.
How has it been since this election?
A little dark,
as everything else.
Not so positive, but still good. And they're giving a lot of suggestions.
What I find really, I mean, not that there's like a good side, but I do feel like everyone's like, oh my gosh, but then it switches really quickly of like, here's what we can do.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the direction people are going, which is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great, thanks. You have a question, Lou?
I was going to ask restaurant recommendation.
Ooh.
Let me see. Right in this neighborhood is Jack's Wife Frida, which I love. I love. It's so good. I wouldn't even know how to explain it. I guess it is seasonal.
Okay.
But it's just, like, really light, fun, unique flavors. They do Bloody Mary mussels.
Ooh.
Oh.
They do. They always have, like, a really great fish. They have nice wines. It's just a really lovely place.
Ambience,
yeah. I love Ethiopian food. I love Awash.
Yeah, Awash is great.
Yeah.
Nice. Have you been to Zoma? It's not too far. It's on 116th.
Oh,
Yeah, that place is pretty good as well.
Yeah.
Next question, how do you find your books? It's a big question. But
for myself or for the library?
For yourself.
For myself. It's kind of funny. Pretty much all my friends are librarians. We're a very insular people. So we're just constantly sending each other stuff.
So good.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I read the Times book reviews, obviously. The Guardian book reviews. I think they're really good. Mm. My husband subscribes to the Financial Times.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was just all, like, business and economics, you know. But he'll always clip art. I have, like, a personal clipping service. He'll give me articles. And they do a great series called Lunch with FT.
Mm-hmm.
And they've profiled a lot of amazing authors, Zadie Smith, you know, other just, like, fantastic people.
And they also have great book reviews of a lot of stuff, a lot of works in translation, a lot of stuff that's coming out in England that we have to wait a while here, but, you know, interesting. Good stuff.
Cool. Actually, I was thinking about your talking about reference library before. Has anyone ever stumped you? Like,
You know, the worst, I would say I never get stumped. I mean, I'm just going to put it out there. But I would say the worst is if someone who isn't a regular, who I don't know well, leaves, and then I figure it out afterwards. I think that's the reason I don't get stumped, is because I really don't give up. I think, and when you talk to more librarians, a lot of us are like this, where
there's a way, we'll find it.
We just get so relentless. And you'll have somebody walking out the door, and you're like, wait, let me check. They're like, it's cool, just leave it alone. Like, I don't need to know that bad.
There's a passing curiosity for them, and you're like, no, we must know.
Right. So I do tend to get a little fixated.
Well, that makes me curious about the channels. Like, you know, there's that whole Google something. How do you find information, I guess? Like, searching for books, different keywords, different...
Yeah.
Like...
Well, here, I mean, since what I do now is so specific, we have a really great program. And for any home cooks, they would love this too. We subscribe to Eat Your Books. And I think for a certain number of titles, it's free. And then after, like, we have to pay. And after a certain level, you have to pay. But basically what it does, you just enter the ISBN number of your cookbook, and it indexes every single recipe, every single ingredient, style of cooking, title of recipe.
Holy crap.
So, like, at Book Riot, I brought up the example of chorizo, right?
Yes.
And you saw our collection. You walked around. So we have a section for charcuterie. We have a section for Spain. We have a section for appetizers. Mm-hmm. And when I search Eat Your Books, I'll find all of them. And I'll be able to look at the differences between the recipes. So that has been invaluable for me. And same with the black rum cake I mentioned. That's how I was able to find, you know, like, British didn't really cross my mind. But, like, obviously, Jamaica was a colony of England. So, of course, it's going to be in British cookbooks. Yeah, but I just didn't put it together.
Yeah, you don't always make those connections. Which you mentioned, like... You don't know how people did this job before the signal.
I know. It's kind of pathetic, but it's true. But we're very quaint here. I still use the due date cards, and I still stamp them, you know. And
nice.
That's so cute.
We have a very primitive circulation system.
It works.
So, so I don't get to do, like, people can't renew online. They have to call me. And
So you make lots of friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone knows you.
You can't, like, log into your account like you can at NYPL.
I guess you are the person to know if you're in a culinary school, like, make friends with your librarian.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. People bring you gifts.
Yeah, sometimes.
That's nice. Sometimes. Like, thanks, you helped me ace that final.
Yeah.
Life-saving.
Do you have a go-to comfort dish that you cook yourself?
I mean, very recently, this is a new one for me. I got the, this is kind of a shameful confession too, but I got
my favorite, the
Chrissy Teigen cookbook, which around these parts is not, it's frowned upon.
There's a lot of judgment.
A lot of judgment, but she does a lasagna with zucchini instead of noodles.
Ooh.
It is so good. It's so good.
I discovered that when I went, like, gluten-free on a whim for a while.
Okay.
I felt great.
Yeah, you feel good, right?
Yeah, you feel great, but then I'm like, but I love bread. But yeah, the zucchini is, like, so dexterous as a food.
You can definitely
kind of substitute it for so many other things.
Definitely. But then I guess also lasagna. Prior to finding out about the zucchini, I love lasagna. I'm like Garfield.
Great. Awesome.
Let me think. What book do you remember your parents reading to you?
Ferdinand the Bull.
Yes.
What's that?
Oh, it's this beautiful story about a bull that doesn't want to be scary and aggressive. He just wants to smell flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Aww.
He doesn't want to go to the bull fight. But he's big, so they want him to fight.
Yeah. Oh,
sounds good. Cute.
Yeah.
That's probably why I'm such a tender, sensitive soul now.
Like those
early
roots.
Memories. Yeah.
Yeah, that'll do it. You think of some more questions, love? Let's maybe do two more?
Yeah.
Investigate. Let's see. What is there a book that you have gifted a lot? that comes to mind. Books are hard because you're person specific trying to pick a book.
They're so person specific. Let me think. I mean, I always give Ferdinand the Bull to friends who get pregnant. That's like my baby gift. But that's answering the same same way.
That's okay. Yeah, well, it's allowed.
I've been trying to give cookbooks now. I don't know if people like it or not, but
they're like typical. How unsurprising of you.
Yeah.
Do you obviously cater to people's palates?
Yeah, of course.
You're like, oh, you love this, so I'm thinking you'll love this.
Yeah, cookbook. I'm kind of in the same way that I consider myself a library advocate. I'm attempting to be a home cooking advocate.
Yeah.
And actually, we had an author visit here. I won't mention her name because I don't know if she's proud of this or not, but it's hilarious. She, whenever people send her books, if she doesn't want them because she already has too many, she chooses one of her neighbors and leaves it on their doorstep. And she's like, I saw somebody had Blue Apron boxes, so I think I can get them. I think if they're doing Blue Apron now, maybe by next year I'll get them actually cooking.
Yeah. Blue Apron's a good starter step.
Yeah, right?
An intermediary. It makes it seem possible if you're coming from pizza and bagels.
Right,
and like
from nothing.
It's so easy, too, to just like, just, what am I saying? Subsidize your diet with like external things that you like forget.
It's
that there's so many things
convenient
you can do
here.
At home.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
When it comes to cooking and eating, are there any cuisines that you just have never gotten on board with?
That's a good question.
Because Chris doesn't like truffles, and I don't know how that's possible.
Really?
Yeah. I also don't eat seafood, so that's like...
It eliminates a lot.
My husband is a lot more adventurous eater than me, so he'll get things like that my friend and I call the unique meats. And I'll try like a bite
of
it.
Or the tongue.
Oh, yeah. Any part of an animal, he'll eat it. And I'll always try a little bit, but I can never really... And a lot of it's mental, right?
Yeah. Sure.
Like when you actually taste
it. If it looks like
it,
a tongue, you're like, oh, I can't eat that. Nope. I cannot put that in my mouth.
Right. So maybe that's like a new goal. Maybe that'll be my 2017 New Year's resolution to eat some unique meats. And
yeah. How do you feel about insects?
I've never tasted. I think it's a good concept. Yeah. I'm obsessed with Dom, the cookbook from Brazil, and he's a big advocate for that. He talks about it a lot. Actually, a lot of the Latin American chefs, too. We have the Peru cookbook, and it's the same in there, where, I don't know, they have more of a understanding or more of an acceptance of it, I think. But, like, did you guys see Snowpiercer?
Yeah.
So, you know, I won't give it away. No spoilers. Yeah. If you haven't seen it, watch it. But the point is our meat supply is going to run out soon. So we need to get on board with some type of other protein source.
Yeah.
And it's as far as the amount of resources, like the ratio of resources to protein, like insects are way more efficient than beef or chicken or whatnot.
Right.
So that makes sense. And that, I will say, like, I've had crickets and grasshoppers. And they're good. I mean, as long like anything else, as long as, like... Grasshoppers I've had like as tacos at some Mexican restaurants, and like they're prepared well, then it's delicious.
Yeah.
So same as anything else.
Yeah.
I think it's just getting past Americans' cultural bias against
insects. Again, it's more mental. It's not.
It's all in our heads.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for letting us crash your work. And
thank you.
Take your time. I'm looking forward to this. And so this series, How to Write a Cookbook, is open to the public if they RSVP.
It is. Yeah, you just need to RSVP.
And it's, you said it's monthly?
Yeah, it's monthly.
Okay.
So once you subscribe to my newsletter, you'll see it. And you can also check the ICC blog. I always post on there if I'm going to host someone. And I also do a column on there called Library Notes, where I do different kind of themed book reviews each month.
Nice.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our visit ended appropriately with gifts of bread from the day's classes. We enjoyed crunchy breadsticks and were lucky to grab some more delicious bread to take home for later. How was the focaccia, Chris?
Delicious.
I'm sure. Hey, quick thank you for listening. This is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Please share your thoughts on Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at inkandworm@gmail.com. While you're at it, check out the community at Radio Free Brooklyn and consider becoming a Patreon member to support the shows that you love. For river writing, I want to do one of my favorite poems that's sort of wintry. River writing
if you haven't heard of it, is just kind of train of thought, writing with the flow, no judgment, no editing, pen to the page, keep going until, like, for a certain amount of time, timed writing, and then we give people the opportunity to read on their show. So Chris and I decided to do it this week solo, and we might grab Sarah later, in which case we'll edit her in, which will be awesome, but otherwise it's just us. So the poem is called Snow Aldo by Kate DiCamillo. And so you're grabbing the, like, thought or line that's standing out to you. And I'll just read it once. Once I was in New York in Central Park, and I saw an old man in a black overcoat walking. A black dog. This was springtime, and the trees were still bare, and the sun was gray. And lo, it began suddenly to snow. Big, fat flakes that twirled and landed on the back of the man's overcoat and the black dog's fur. The dog lifted his face and stared up at the sky. The man looked up too. Snow, Aldo, he said to the dog. Snow. And he laughed. And the dog looked at him and wagged his tail. If I was in charge of making snow globes, this is what I would put inside. The old man in the black overcoat, the black dog, two friends with their faces turned up to the sky, as if they were receiving a blessing, as if they were being blessed together by something as simple as snow in March. So if you need a place to start, maybe say, if I was in charge of making snow globes. If you get stuck, maybe writing, what I really want to say is, or revisiting whatever line is standing out to you. So if you are listening to the podcast, you can push pause and do your own timed writing. We wrote for 6 minutes. And do you want to read first, Chris, or do you want me to go first?
I'll go first.
Swell.
Okay. So, I've always associated snow with happiness. Maybe it's because I've always loved the water, and its frozen form is less equally lovable. Regardless, many positive memories come with thoughts of snow. I remember finishing my first semester of college. I went to school in Vermont, so there was more than enough snow to go around. After I finished my last exam, I plunged into the night. Crunching across campus, I listened to one of my favorite Coldplay songs. Yes, Coldplay, deal with it. Life felt like it could not be more perfect. I had survived my first semester, I had lots of great friends, and there was even a date with a cute ski patroller on my horizon. That snowy evening felt awash with possibilities, like I'd finally reached that point where, perched on the ledge, I could let out my wings and soar into any number of fantastic futures. Snow fell around me, I smiled, and I said to myself, and so it begins.
Thank you. I have this picture I took out of my grandmother's window. I remember it because it was big, fat, sticky snowflakes framed by a beautiful snowscape. I had just returned to Utah after living in Georgia, and I had forgotten how magical the snow is. I try to think of good moments, and rediscovering the magic of snow is definitely one of them. What I really want to say is that there are breaths in life and in nature that feel infinite in their possibilities. That things feel right, but also there are a number of other moments as well, and sometimes it feels easy, and sometimes it feels hard to hold space and process some moments. I'm so often surprised at the intensity and emotion that can arise when I am recalling an awkward moment shared years ago with someone whom I am no longer even talking to, and I try to breathe that moment out and this one in. Kind of wandering. Thanks for listening.
So the line that jumped out to me, I don't know it exactly, but I just wrote down snow as a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
All too often, weather here is a frustration, a distraction, a problem. But when do I ever stop and think of what a blessing snow is? What a miracle that something so lovely can fall out of the sky unexpectedly, then blanket the whole city so it all looks fresh and clean that very first day. Sure, it's cold. Sure, there are sometimes headaches and hassles and troubles. But it brings beauty to ugly stretches of sidewalk, covering the dog waste in beer bottles, It reminds us of the power and majesty of this world we live in. It makes it a little bit easier to believe in magic. Oh, that was stunning. Thank you for sharing.
This is our Christmas special, I suppose. Happy holidays to everyone listening. And maybe in honor, we can talk about a book that we think of when we think about books around Christmas time. Do you have like a Christmas story tradition in your family?
Yeah, always on Christmas Eve, we would read "Twas the Night Before Christmas."
Mm.
Very original. I'm sure no other American family does that.
Yeah, that's really unique. Never heard of that before.
Yeah, who knows? That's very, it's a very unique book, little known. but yeah, it's always fun. I mean, we even did it last year, right? And
mm-hmm.
All the kids are in our 20s.
Yeah.
But yeah, we just, someone reads a page, then we pass the next person, they read a page. And
that's cute.
Yeah, it's funny, the older I've gotten, how much shorter the book is. Like when you're a kid,
you're like, oh, it's never gonna end.
Yeah, but now it's like we read it and we're like, it took
a couple minutes. You're like, okay, should we read it again?
Yeah.
I have two traditions come to mind, and both of them were instigated by my mom. One of them was we would read the Bible account of Christ being born and remember the real reason why we're gathering.
Which generosity. Account would you read?
I believe Luke.
Okay. But they all differ slightly.
Yeah, I know. In later years, as I was able to intellectualize, I was like,
suspicious.
Very suspicious. I believe Luke or John, I know, is that bad that I don't even remember.
I think it's Luke.
Very impactful, obviously. <Yeah. laughs> Luke is the more commonly read one, I believe, so I want to say it was that. And then the other thing that I liked, but I also not very attached to, is Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol.
Mm.
Watching that either film or on stage. We actually stopped by Housing Works while they were reading it, which was fun, busy, but we missed the beginning, so we didn't stay for the end.
Yeah, and that's, have you ever actually read it?
Yeah, I don't love Dickens' writing. Some people probably will be mad at me for saying that. He's a classic!
Throw a brick through Radio Free Brooklyn's window.
Yeah, no more Ink and Worm. I'm done with the trash. No, but yeah.
I've actually never read Dickens. So what don't you like about him? I'm curious.
I mean, I don't know. The voice is really nostalgic for a lot of people. You know, speaking of nostalgia.
Yeah.
But for me, it never really came off as that. It always came off as a little arduous and hard to follow.
Okay.
I suppose it's comparable to reading Shakespeare, and you kind of have to put in the time and effort and energy to like appreciate and enjoy reading Shakespeare. And if you just dive into it, it's really hard at first. I feel like maybe it's like that, which I'm like,
I like Shakespeare.
Yeah, but it's hard to just like dive into and follow. I think for me, not exactly the same, but similar way, just like I had to really focus to like understand what he was saying.
Hmm. Interesting. I do think it is really impressive. I mean, if you put aside all of his other works, just, I mean, like A Christmas Carol is such an influential piece. I mean, just to give one example, I mean, it's like one of the most adapted, if mm-hmm. not the single most adapted
Christmas
story. Yeah, or it's single most adapted story.
Do you think so? Like across all genres?
Yeah, I read that a couple years ago.
Facts. Like, yeah, we only got facts here.
Yeah, what about the facts? Yeah, I forget, but there's like a couple dozen like film and television adaptations.
Yeah, because I remember watching different versions and being like, it's the same story, but I mean, I remember this Disney version with Mickey Mouse for some reason.
It's funny you should mention that because Caitlin, who's my older sister, for the record, loves that
version.
Yeah, and so we have it on VHS at
home.
Wasn't
there a Muppet version as well?
Yeah.
I think that's the one I recall more.
Michael Caine is Scrooge in that one.
Oh, yes, this is true. okay, so Caitlin's favorite is the cartoon with Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, we would watch that every Christmas.
So touching. I guess of all the things that are like Mickey Mouse-esque, that's probably my favorite Mickey Mouse thing. So that's something, right?
Yeah. I wonder what it is just about that story, though, that people
love. I think, well, it speaks to the themes of reflection. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who December is kind of their month to look back on the year, to think about the next year and like get ready for those New Year's resolutions or something comparable. I mean, I know my tradition is finding a word for the year. And so this year my word was nurture. So throughout the year, I would just kind of like focus on, you know, that word as like a concept and things that I'm trying to do and goals. And then my next year, fairly certain, but not 100%, that my word is going to be curiosity. So like just kind of a word to go with my year is what I do. And then I like smaller projects. I don't like making New Year's resolutions. Are you a resolution maker?
No, but I think that's less because I'm opposed to resolutions and more because I just continually make plans, short-term and long-term, and they're always running.
You just do things.
yeah. So I guess you could say I don't really need New Year's resolutions.
You don't
resolution.
Need a day.
Yeah, because I'm like, I already made plans.
You're like, I'm good. I thought about this week last week.
Yeah.
Good job.
I'm trying.
You have like the responsible approach. Mine's like more fluffy of like, well, I don't really want to peg myself down to things, you know, that 9 months later might not be very exciting for me. I do like 100-day challenges. I think if anything, that's my thing. Just like 100 days, I'm going to do blank or not do blank. So
yeah, that's good. The time pressure of that, I think, is good.
An end in sight.
Yeah, I think it's a bit more realistic, actually, than a New Year's resolution. Because honestly, a year is too long for most people.
Yeah.
Like, there's a reason gyms always say, like, they have a major uptick in the first, like, 2 months. Yeah, and then after that, it's, like, back to business as usual.
Yeah. Well, anyways, tell us about your traditions. Do you have any opinions about the Christmas Carol or Night Before Christmas? What else did we? Oh, and or the Bible. You know, if you have any about yeah. You know, the story of Christ. You know, those are great stories too. And we're wishing you happy holidays from Ink and Worm for listening. If you missed anything, you can catch the podcast on Stitcher, iTunes, or Audioboom. While you're at it, you could hit subscribe. And if you wanted to leave a review, we'd love to hear your thoughts. And I'll leave you with a word. Take it or leave it.
Makes me